optimal minimalism.
At this altitude, I can run flat out for a half mile before my hands start shaking.
Can I ask you a personal question?
Now would have seemed an appropriate time.
What if I did the opposite?
I'm a cybernetic organism, living tissue over a metal endoskeleton.
This episode is brought to you by Athletic Greens. I get asked all the time what I would take if I could only take one supplement. The answer is invariably Athletic Greens. I view it as all-in-one nutritional insurance. I recommended it, in fact, in the 4-Hour Body. This is more than 10 years ago, and I did not get paid to do so. With approximately 75 vitamins, minerals, and whole food sourced ingredients, you'd be very hard-pressed to find a more nutrient-dense and comprehensive formula on the market. It has multivitamins, multimineral greens complex, probiotics and prebiotics for gut health, an immunity formula, digestive enzymes, adaptogens, and much more. I usually take it once or twice a day just to make sure I've covered my bases if I miss anything I'm not aware of. Of course, I focus on nutrient-dense meals to begin with. That's the basis. But Athletic Greens makes it easy to get a lot of nutrition when whole foods aren't readily available. From travel packets, I always have them in my bag when I'm zipping around. Right now, Athletic Greens is giving my audience a special offer on top of their all-in-one formula, which is a free vitamin D supplement and 5 free travel packs with your first subscription purchase. Many of us are deficient in vitamin D. I've found that true for myself, which is usually produced in our body from sun exposure. So adding a vitamin D supplement to your daily routine is a great option for additional immune support. Support your immunity, gut health, and energy by visiting athleticgreens.com/TFS. You'll receive up to a year's supply of vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your subscription. Again, that's athleticgreens.com/TFS, as in Tim Ferriss Show. athleticgreens.com/TFS. This episode is brought to you by 5-Bullet Friday, my very own email newsletter. It's become one of the most popular email newsletters in the world with millions of subscribers, and it's super, super simple. It does not clog up your inbox. Every Friday, I send out 5 bullet points, super short, of the coolest things I've found that week, which sometimes includes apps, books, documentaries, supplements, gadgets, new self-experiments, hacks, tricks, and all sorts of weird stuff that I dig up from around the world. You guys, podcast listeners and book readers, have asked me for something short and action-packed for a very long time, because after all, the podcast, the books, they can be quite long. And that's why I created 5-Bullet Friday. It's become one of my favorite things I do every week. It's free. It's always going to be free. And you can learn more at tim.blog/Friday. That's tim.blog/Friday. I get asked a lot how I meet guests for the podcast, some of the most amazing people I've ever interacted with. And little known fact, I've met probably 25% of them because they first subscribed to 5-Bullet Friday. So you'll be in good company. It's a lot of fun. 5-Bullet Friday is only available if you subscribe via email. I do not publish the content on the blog or anywhere else. Also, if I'm doing small in-person meetups, offering early access to startups, beta testing, special deals, or anything else that's very limited, I share it first with 5-Bullet Friday subscribers. So check it out, tim.blog/Friday. If you listen to this podcast, it's very likely that you'd dig it a lot. And you can, of course, easily subscribe anytime. So easy peasy. Again, that's tim.blog/Friday. And thanks for checking it out, if the spirit moves you.
Hello, ladies and germs. This is Tim Ferriss, and welcome to another episode of The Tim Ferriss Show, where each episode it is my job to deconstruct world-class performers, to tease out the habits, routines, morning rituals, favorite books, etc., that have made them spectacularly good at what they do. And there are patterns that you notice across disciplines. That is why I interview people from a very broad spectrum of areas, like the military, entertainment, chess, sports, comedy, etc. So it ranges from Arnold Schwarzenegger to General Stanley McChrystal. And now, in this episode, we have a dynamic duo. We have Seth Rogen, at Seth Rogen, R-O-G-E-N, who is an actor, writer, producer, and director. and his partner in crime, Evan Goldberg, at Evan D. Goldberg on the Twitters, who is a Canadian director, screenwriter, and producer. Together, they get into a whole lot of mischief and create some amazing comedy. I had a chance to spend some time with both of these great gents, as well as their team, which is spectacular. And I won't mention the location in case they're keeping that quiet, but here's some background. They've collaborated on films such as Superbad, which they actually first conceived of as teenagers, Knocked Up, Pineapple Express, The Green Hornet, and Funny People. They've also written for The Ali G Show and The Simpsons. In 2013, Evan and Seth released their directorial debut, This Is the End, which was actually a combination of two different ideas, and we get into that in the conversation. In 2014, Seth starred in and produced, alongside Evan, Neighbors, which was a worldwide comedy hit and has taken in more than $268 million worldwide. And then appearing in the news yet again in December 2014, Rogan and Goldberg's film The Interview became easily the most talked about news story around the world. And that was not just in the entertainment mags, but in every different publication because of many reasons. So under extremely difficult circumstances, the film persevered to become Sony Pictures' number one digital title of all time. Neighbors 2 is shooting right now and will be released next May. Seth and Evan are also in production on Sausage Party, which I saw a clip of, a prelim clip, which is a raunchy animated movie for adults about one sausage's quest to discover the truth about his existence. And I really hope to God that some of the raunchier scenes make it in because they will make your head explode. Seth and Evan are producing that film with Megan Ellison and Conrad Vernon. In our conversation, the one you're about to listen to, we discuss all manner of tactics and silliness, including Kyokushin Karate, empty hand, and how they participated in that, writer's block and related debates, does it exist, does it not exist, how do you contend with it, if it does, writing process. I ask questions like, who are the most underrated comedians and comedy writers? What is the odd book that Judd Apatow recommended to them, which happens to also be Woody Allen's favorite? How Superbad got made after they first drafted around age 13, how Kids in the Hall influenced them, the movie they both wish they'd written, common pot mistakes. So if you're just listening to this for a marijuana playbook, well, there might be something in here for you as well. So recommended noob pot for working versus relaxing, and much, much more. So I really hope you enjoy this. As always, if you're not getting my 5-Bullet Friday newsletter, check it out. It is a very, very popular. It's just a short email with a lot of tactical stuff. Gets sent out every Friday. You can check that out, 4hourworkweek.com/Friday. That's all spelled out, 4hourworkweek.com/Friday, or just go to 4hourworkweek.com and enter your email there. And for all the show notes for this episode, all the links, etc., just go to 4hourworkweek.com and click on podcast. So without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg. Evan, Seth, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
I appreciate you guys taking the time, especially in this very busy, busy month that you gents have. And I thought we could start with a story that we discussed a little bit, Evan, in the car, which was Kyokushin. So tell me about your karate.
Karate?
He knows Kyokushin guy.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's so funny. We were talking about when we were kids how we behaved and how I was a softie. And so I did rugby and karate to try and toughen myself up. And I joined at the Jewish Community Center, which is one of the places we became really good friends.
Yes,
Seth
true.
Had been doing it a few years before me.
Yeah.
We'd already met in bar mitzvah class. And our parents were like, Jewish Community Center, that can't be much, you know, just simple karate. And they let us beat the living shit out of each other.
Yeah. It was pretty, I realized like we were the bad guys from Karate Kid.
You were the Cobra Kai.
We were Cobra Kai. Yeah. Like
we were banned from tournaments.
We were banned from tournaments. And then we finally went to a tournament and I realized that like the way they taught us to fight, like was not conducive to tournament fighting. And I punched a guy in the throat and got disqualified from the tournament basically. And I didn't know that that wasn't like what you were supposed to do. Like I was just like, oh, we're supposed to beat the shit out of this
That's
person.
What you were conditioned to respond
yeah,
with.
Yeah, like I have a memory of one time where they made me fight that like 35-year-old woman when I was 14, and she like choked me out on the ground until I passed out.
Wait, this was in class?
Yeah. I remember fighting like full-grown men too. I remember hitting that guy Rod so hard.
This guy Rod was like a 280-pound, 6'3" guy, and he was like 14.
I was like 14, and I hit him so hard in the face with like a spinning backhand that he, it like knocked him it like almost knocked him out. It like dazed him completely. And then they let me, then they like, they let him fight me again. And he like punched me in the mouth so hard. I like couldn't, I couldn't like, I think my mouth started bleeding. And then I hurt, and then, but, oh man, there's so many stories that are flooding. Well, I haven't thought about it for so long.
There's the
but,
day that ended it all where yeah. I got kicked in the hip by a 40-year-old black belt who fractured my hip.
Yeah.
And then he backed up into a pillar and got a piece of wood lodged in his foot and thus ended our Kyokushin yeah. career.
But I remember fighting the teacher on the ground one time. Like, the teacher, Sean, would like, I remember like grappling on the ground with him and like to the point where he would just like do anything you can. And I was like trying to bite him. I was like spitting on him. And like that was like what you were supposed to do in the class.
One time like, when I was
and
doing
if,
that,
and if you didn't, you would get in trouble. And he'd be like, "You could do more." Like
yeah, one time I spat in his face, and then he took the spit and rubbed
yeah,
it in my
did
face.
The exact same thing to
and
me.
And just started slapping yeah, me yeah, with my spit all over my face.
Literally the exact same thing to me.
And we thought it was like. This is what I thought that was
what Jewish Community Center karate is. Yeah.
So you mentioned Kyokushin. You're like, I don't think, you know, people get the wrong image when I tell them karate. And I, from having lived in Japan for a year as an exchange student, it was the first time I got exposed to Kyokushin. And those were like the bad boys of the karate world. It was very well known. Like, you don't want to get the leg kicks were very famous.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Dude, one time I got there was this guy, the dentist. There was like, we fought like grown men.
Sounds like a ring.
This was child abuse.
Oh, it really was. And like, this guy had the longest legs in the entire world.
He had these little brown slippers on.
Yeah. And he just like kept kicking my legs out from under me relentlessly. And there was nothing I could do to stop it.
All of us, they made all of us watch as he did it to him for like 10 minutes.
Yeah. And just like, I just like would get up and then like try to fight again. And he would just like smack my legs out from under me. And just like, I remember just like hitting the ground like a ton of bricks.
There was this one guy, the guy who ended up fracturing my hip, which ruined my rugby and karate.
Fracturing your hip is not a small
hairline fracture. Yeah. It wasn't terrible, but it's enough that I couldn't run and stuff like that. Malcolm. He would do this thing. To this day, I can't comprehend how he did it. In a movie, you wouldn't believe it. He literally, like, casually put both hands behind his back in a small room and was try and hit me. And I couldn't. And I'm like 15, 16, real fit. I've been doing karate for like 5 years, and I couldn't even touch him.
Yeah. I remember Malcolm kicked me in the eye once so hard that my parents had to call their family friends who were eye doctors and take me to their house after the karate class because I like couldn't see out of one of my eyes for like 3 hours.
But I regret nothing.
I regret nothing either. It's weird. It's weird now because I'm so – and I was always like not a violent person and I'm not competitive and I don't like care about any of that stuff that much.
So did it turn you guys off of that type of thing sort of indefinitely past that point? Or
certainly as somebody who has like TMJ and like has had some joint issues, I can identify that that is – too brutal. Like their knuckles were all puffed up and because we would break boards and if you didn't break the board – you had to try again. Like, I split a knuckle in two.
Yeah.
Sounds like a liability nightmare.
It's weird because it was happening at the Jewish Community Center. And that's what's so strange about it. And I don't think any of our parents, my parents would come and watch sometime, but they thought, I don't think anyone had a frame of reference maybe. So they just thought, like, oh, that's what karate class is.
No, my parents would just pick me up and, like, not comment that I was bleeding from somewhere.
No, my parents would come sometimes because I started when I was younger. So they, like, knew. I did it for, like, over. I think I did it for 10 years or something like
that. I did it for 7 and you did it 3 more.
Yeah, I think I started. Yeah, I did it for
And we
really
did it with our
time.
Buddy Fogel and our buddy Corber and our buddy Glansberg, and they would just make us, as friends, beat the shit out of each other.
Yeah, it was pretty. Glansberg was soft. He was never.
But he got to fight the younger guys, which made him probably feel pretty good.
Yeah.
And when did you guys first meet? I mean, first encounter each other?
I went to like 2 hours of after school Hebrew school Tuesday, Thursday, and he went to like a half Hebrew school, half normal school.
It was pretty much like, it was like a Hebrew school. No, it was like, they did half and half studies, but it was like a full on like Jewish elementary
and
school.
He would get out when I would go in, and I took the class at the synagogue, which was beside his school.
Right.
So we would see each other for years. We didn't really know each other, but we would see
just
each other.
Guy.
And I was kind of like the loudest person from this side, and he was the
but
loudest
you were friends
person
with Fogel.
Side. This guy Sammy Fogel, who's the McLovin of Superbad, he's not really that big a loser, we just messed with him. He and I became good friends, and Seth's mother and his mother were good friends, and then it all kind of culminated to bar mitzvah class.
Yeah,
we all took Sunday morning, what was it called?
Tullison to fill in
class, where they would give us chocolate milk and bagels to lure us in to learn how to do our bar mitzvah portions.
Yeah, I'd go to bar mitzvah class if you give me.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. It's a weird mix, but it's delicious.
Yeah, and we just kind of met there, and because of Fogel, we became friends.
Yeah.
And when did you guys start collaborating creatively?
In hindsight, like 8 months later.
Yeah, pretty early.
How old were you guys at the time?
Around 13.
12, 13.
It was literally, it's not like we pretend we don't remember. We don't remember, but we were watching some crappy movie. And we just looked at each other and we're like, we could write a better movie. And there's like a pause and it's like, we should write a better movie.
And I think I was doing stand-up already at that point. And so like, there was some context for like, we can write things and they'll become things. Like, I was already like writing things and then performing them. So it wasn't just like we actually like wanted to make a movie. Like it wasn't, and I'd already seen like, oh, you can tangibly like do something. Like,
and you know, like, oh, you came all the way from Canada, and it's not like Vancouver's a movie town.
Yeah, Vancouver's
they filmed like, movies at our high school. Like,
we're from a bigger city than almost anyone that we know in America is from.
And they all think we're like bumpkins.
Exactly. Like, we're from a real city and where they made tons of movies. And so you would see movie sets everywhere growing up. At our high school, they shot a lot of movies.
That Lou Diamond Phillips movie? Mastermind starring Patrick Stewart.
Patrick Stewart and Vincent Kartheiser. It's not a fantastic movie, but it was shot at our high school. And and so you would see it around, and so it was like it was kind of we didn't know anyone in the business or anything like that or who was involved in movies, but it was just like around, and so
first interaction was our friend Amelia Wasserman's mother
produced kids shows.
And she like let me try to write some kids episodes and gave me some
that's
pointers.
Cool.
And I think Julian Marinus's dad like produced TV shows or something like that. I can't remember. Like, we knew people whose parents like had like kind of like, you know, jobs in the, like it was around. It was just kind of around.
Yeah, this girl I dated, Abby Salzberg, her mother was a writer for the newspaper, and she kind of gave me some pointers and helped me out. So we had like some help, but we didn't really have a hard in.
Yeah. I think one of my distant cousins was a producer on Passenger 57, the Wesley Snipes movie.
Yeah, I remember that.
And that I remember hearing as a child.
it's really fascinating that so you're given the opportunity to kind of tinker in the writing perspective with these episodes. When I grew up next to the gent who created the Choose Your Own Adventure book series.
What?
Yeah,
that's awesome.
And so we had, my brother and I, chances to test drive his books
awesome.
And provide feedback.
And you're just like, this is a bad choice.
Well, yeah. if we gave him feedback he ended up using, he would put our names into the books. So, if you go back, there are a handful
there's
of books.
There's Tim's in the books?
Tim Ferriss is no less.
Tim Ferriss is in the book.
And they were a power
Tim
couple.
Tim Ferriss was walking through the woods one night.
Did he go left towards the
dark path?
Yeah,
he was warned the mountains are dangerous.
And you guys, is it true that you started working on Superbad around that time?
That's what we started writing.
We sat down and started that. That was the first thing we ever tried to do.
Was writing Superbad.
And it was
terrible
awful.
At first, but it was really bad at first. But that being said, we liked movies so much and were so into movies that like looking back, we kind of instinctually like understood the vague structure of movies in like a pretty instinctual way. Right. And like
and we loved bad movies, which I think actually was extremely beneficial because it showed us what not to do.
We watched tons of B movies.
There was this place called Videomatica. Was that what it was called? There were 7 movies for $7 for 7 days.
Yeah, it was great.
And we would go and do that. And watch them all.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, get like 2 good movies and 5 crappy movies.
But then around this time was when movies like Pulp Fiction and Clerks and like that, like Rushmore and Bottle Rocket, like it was kind of like the dawn of like 90s independent cinema. And we were really, really into those movies too. And again, a lot of those movies, you know, at least in theory had kind of like a do-it-yourself feel where Kevin Smith just made Clerks.
It's clearly like they just got a camera.
They just made it.
A bunch of friends were like, let's fucking do this, and they did it.
And that was very like inspirational to us because it just seemed very achievable, you know? And so I think that's one of the reasons we, again, started doing it. It was just like, it was about high school kids. We knew high school kids. I wanted to be an actor. We knew there was other kids in our school who were trying to be actors and stuff like that. And so it just kind of seemed like we, like, if we write a high school movie, we could make a high school movie, basically.
Yeah, and he had his stand-up start. And for me, it was like when I was like 5 years old, if you asked me what I wanted to do, was be a writer. I always wanted to be a writer. They actually tried to send me to a psychiatrist in elementary school because I would write like dark stuff. Because my at Hebrew school, I learned about the Holocaust, and I kept writing about the Holocaust, and they thought there was something wrong with me.
But I remember Evan when we met, he was like the first person I ever met who like wrote recreationally other than me. Like I wrote stand up, and he wrote like stories and stuff like that. And I remember like when you're like a 13-year-old kid, it's like you know, meet a lot of other 13-year-old kids who's like one of their hobbies is writing recreationally. It's not that common. And so
and he kind of made me realize with the stand up, he was like he just did it. And so we both were like, what if we just did this? No one at this age is trying to do it. So if we get a jump on it, maybe we'll do okay. And also, it seemed like the easiest path to becoming a writer. Like I've tried to write a novel once and I failed. It is really hard.
Novels are hard.
Yeah.
And it's funny you mentioned the school psychologist. So I was sent to the school psychologist also.
Everyone in this room.
Sent to several.
Because I was forced to do writing assignments I didn't want to do. And so thematically, I would turn them into stories about serial killers and different types of murder.
That's kind
of
what I did.
I think it's a common reaction. Right?
I wrote a dystopian future story about a bunch of kids trying to get out of a Nazi-controlled future, and it ended with all of them dying.
You invented the young adult novel. You invented Divergent and the Hunger Games.
And I remember the reason they tried to send me to shrink is because I drew the picture of all their corpses at the end.
Oh, nice. That's a nice touch. Yeah, for those people who wouldn't take the time to read it.
You've got to really spell it out sometimes.
What was the difference for you, Seth, then in the early days between what were the biggest differences between writing for stand-up, and this could be contemporary, like in general, and writing for film, for instance?
I've thought about it a lot. And when we started writing movies, I honestly and when we started doing it more, I kind of became less interested in writing stand-up in some ways because, like, and I honestly think that good stand-up. I wasn't the best stand-up comedian is one thing. Like I was pretty good. I was like a B+ stand-up comedian, A-. I wasn't like an A+ stand-up comedian. And I'm not saying that we're like the best script writers in the world, but we've achieved A+ moments, I think, here and there. And so that was one of the things I was just like aware of. I would just like watch other people do it and be like, wow, this guy's like doing something like that they're just better at it than I am, you know? And when we started writing movies, I started to feel like, oh, like we act like this, I feel like we could maybe, again, like really carve out our own niche doing, which I didn't feel like I was particularly doing stand-up. I was young, and that was at first a niche, is like I would write about my young person's experience. But then as I got older, I found like, I don't know. As a stand-up, I was struggling a little bit to find a unique perspective.
I have a theory. You cease to be tortured.
Yeah, exactly. That was part of it. I was like really tortured when I was. I mean, I wasn't that tortured,
not really tortured, but young neuroses and anxiety.
Yeah, it's true.
Stand-up comics function largely, not all of them, but a lot of them on anxiety and worry and like self-obsessed.
I don't have that much. Yeah, I don't find myself that interesting. Is honestly one of the other things. Is like I think writing, and that's one of the reasons I think writing movies was better, is because I was writing other people. And I also struggled with stand-up, is that you can only really, and again, good stand-ups do this, but I couldn't find a way to do it, is like, I can only talk from one perspective in stand-up. But in a movie, you can write two or three or four or five or six perspectives all in one scene. You could have five guys arguing or about how to, you know, turn, you know, how to do anything. What's the best way to get out of this room? You know, and as we started writing, like, you know, some of the best scenes that we've ever achieved are literally just people screaming at each other. And so, like, I think that was something that I thought was very funny that we were good at, was like conflict. And it's hard to have like conflict in stand-up comedy. For me, I couldn't find a way to do it. Other people do it, and they tell stories that involve conflict, and the whole thing is about, you know, the struggle. And I look at it now, and sometimes I think, like, man, if I kept doing it, I maybe would have broken through a wall. But I just... I don't know. And I loved movies. That was the other thing. It's just like...
And I loved movies also, but I was a bit more of a comic nerd. He was a comic nerd too, but I was like extreme.
Comic meaning comic book.
Yeah. My brother is a like natural speed reader. He reads at a remarkable pace. He can read a book in a day, like a 400 page book, just burn through it. So he would read comics and mountains of them would form and then he would draw them. So I would mimic him because he was 2 years older and I would read all the comics he read and then try to draw like him. He's actually an expert. He's a very good artist. He drew all the penises for Superbad,
which were good.
and he's did he make a cameo in The Big Lebowski on the notepad?
No, that would have been amazing.
And he's a lawyer now, but I tried to like mimic him with that stuff. And comics are just movie storyboards, really. Definitely.
They're very cinematic. Yeah, and I read all the comic books too. I think that's it. I mean, it's like...
We can connected heavily over Calvin and Hobbes.
Yeah, we love that.
One of the best of all time.
Yeah, but the sarcasm of it like forged our...
it's genius.
But I think we just liked like the cinematic, like again, comics and like it just seemed appealing.
And it's funny that at the time, like if you look at what we've done recently, like we like grandiose things. We like big things to happen, end of the world scenarios and all that. But at the time, all we knew was that we really wanted to get laid. We weren't getting laid, and we weren't super cool.
Yeah.
and I think the reason Superbad worked out is it's rare that you are the thing you're writing on at the moment you're doing it,
right,
and you're self-aware of it.
Yeah. And we're still, I mean, and we, that's something that we've continued to try to do, honestly. I mean, Neighbors, you know, is a very good example.
It's all our friends are having
kids. Our friends are having kids or trying to have kids and are married and are getting older and are moving into different places.
Yeah, and like, I don't have a kid and I want to go out and I call all my friends and none of them can come.
Exactly. And so I think from the get-go, and that's something that came from stand-up comedy. Like, there's a comic named Daryl Lennox who still performs, who is great. And the comics were very nice to me, which is, in retrospect, insane. Because I would not be nice to, like, a 13-year-old kid who was doing stand-up comedy, I don't think. Maybe I would, but I don't assume I would. But I remember he saw me perform, and I used to have, like, jokes. I would try to, like, mimic other comedians, like Stephen Wright or Seinfeld. Like, what's the deal with Crazy Glue? And he was like, dude, you're, like, the only 14-year-old, he's like, you're the only person here who could like talk about trying to get like a hand job for the first time. Like, talk about that. Yeah. Like, that is like so much more interesting than anything you're talking about. Like, why aren't you just talking about that? And I was like, oh, you're right. That's actually a very good way of doing it. And then that kind of carried through everything.
Writing what you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's I've been really fascinated just sort of observing you guys work. And, you know, realizing, at least for me, when you guys started Superbad at a time when those, all of those feelings were very kind of ever present in your lives. And when I look back at, say, past books, people have asked me, like, what would you edit? What would you change? And I don't want to touch it because I feel like it was written at a very precise point in time related to very specific pains that I might not be experiencing now because it's, you know, that chapter is passed on. What does your writing process look like now? A lot of people have asked me to ask you both this, but what is just from the very first sort of concept stages?
Well, as I was telling you earlier, it's changed a little. We just did this project Preacher with a guy named Sam Catlin who worked on Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
And we used to immediately start like kind of, we would always write down ideas and he taught us this new trick of not writing down ideas for a good month and just
talking,
shooting it around and talking and talking and talking. And I kept saying like, now we're going to write. Right. And he was like, no, we just keep talking. And that's a new trick that I think was great. Just spend way more time talking about it.
That's what he said in Breaking Bad they would do is just like before they did anything, they would just talk and talk and talk. And it's something actually like we did on Undeclared when I look back at it. It's like we're just anxious to get going, I think, sometimes. But I feel like now, I mean, and it's kind of always been this way in that like we'll come up with ideas and it's like sometimes it's like there's almost like a Darwinistic process where it's like if they're around a year later or so, like if it's something we're still talking about, sometimes years later. There's this movie that we're talking about writing. I was going through old files, like the first one's from like 2011 or something like that.
I mean, a tangible example is This Is the End. We had two separate ideas. One was a movie about the apocalypse, and another one was celebrities playing themselves in a disaster type scenario. Both of those ideas survived for 4 or 5 years, and they slowly we realized if we merge these things, it's going to be a good synthesis. Yeah. And that's the perfect example. Like we'd just be sitting around working on whatever, and then be like, "What about that apocalypse thing?"
Yeah, or it's just what we talk about. Like, I mean, it's It's like, you know, we like what we do and it's fun for us to think about it. So organically, we'd just be sitting there doing something else. And that's the thing we would just start joking around about, you know. And then if it sticks around, then it at least means that we like it as an idea.
Like lately, I've been obsessed with artificial intelligence and we're not writing anything about that. But in a year from now, if I'm still talking about it, maybe that'll happen.
So when you have something that's really persistent like that, and you have, say, the celebrities playing themselves in the end of the world, and you're like, you know, this could be really interesting if we combine these two things at the time, not necessarily now that you have the input from the Breaking Bad writer on that approach, but what were the next steps that you guys took once you were like, you know what, let's try to pull the trigger on this?
It took us a really long time to figure out how to do it, honestly. Like, that was one of those movies where, bizarrely, it just took us, like, we could think of the first two acts of the movie, and then we couldn't figure out how to end the movie. And it literally took us, like, a year and a half, I think, until we thought of the idea that they realized they can still redeem themselves, basically, which is what allows the third act to happen, which is they're all start trying to redeem themselves. And we just didn't think of that. And it was literally just, like, we couldn't do it. And meanwhile, we're working on other stuff and doing it. It's not like we're just sitting in a room for a year and a half, like, banging our heads against the walls. Like, we're still doing things, but that... in that example, it literally just took us a really long time to come up with the idea that allowed the movie to function. And then once we thought of that idea, I remember we wrote the first draft of this at the end in like 9 days or something like that.
Now, was
like,
that was all three acts or just?
Yeah, we wrote the whole movie, like the whole first, the 120 pages, we wrote the whole script. We sat
in. But it should be said, we had an extensive outline.
Yeah,
because we've been kicking it around for years. And like one thing we do, a lot of our movies are kind of genre based, especially lately, you know, Pineapple Express and This Is the End and The Interview to some degree. And so something we do is just watch tons of movies in that genre. And so like with This Is the End, we just watch tons of these like horror movies and apocalypse movies and movies about isolation and kind of little groups of people that are stuck together. And as we do that, we just start joking around and coming up with ideas. Oh, it would be funny if we send a guy out on a rope. It's like, oh, they need water. And you just kind of pick up these themes in the movies.
Yeah, like when Craig Robinson went out of the house with a rope, that was based off of The Mist.
Exactly.
Right.
And part of it, I mean, and we talk a lot about it, is like really trying to like have our cake and eat it too in these movies. Like it's like we are kind of like mocking the genres as we're trying to participate in them fully, you know? And in doing that, we like to, it's almost like the characters in the movie are aware of the same cultural references that we are, and so it would stand to believe that like all that stuff would be on the table, basically. Right. And so that's a big part of the process, is just lists of ideas, tons of ideas. Jonah gets possessed, someone gets puked on, they need water, someone steals the water, someone doesn't like the rules, they try to make rules, how do they split up the food?
And some of these,
like, do you put this into like a notebook or do you put it into a
Word document. And we'll sometimes,
and it's just
like,
it's just a running list. There's
a rolling list.
I think right now with the latest idea we're messing about,
we have like a 10-page
list. We have like a 10-page list, and I think there's another 10-page list we don't even remember.
And
it literally,
and it's like a relationship type movie. So there's like idea, it's just like things happen to us, and it's just like, oh, a fight about this.
Yeah, and it's as simple as husband who holds back wife, wife who enhances husband's positive qualities.
And then it's just like, it's also just like housewarming party. Like, it's things like that. And like, or we'll go to a party and something funny will happen, and you put that in the
document. So it's just a stream of consciousness collection of these ideas.
And again, like the ideas themselves, as you go through these lists over and over throughout the years, some ideas you kind of stick in your head and you remember, and some start to seem stupid. And you start to create characters kind of based on the ideas, or sometimes you come up with the characters first, and sometimes you'll just meet someone and you'll be like, someone like that, like someone who is going through this in life, or you know what I mean? And it can come from anywhere. And then for a while we got really, and then process wise, I think we kind of strayed a little bit in that we got so busy, we started kind of like farming it out a little bit to other people, which is something that we're kind of trying to not do as much.
Yeah, we wanted to do a lot of stuff, and so we had other people writing stuff for us, and it all worked out very well, but we got a hankering to just sit down.
I think our biggest skill, I think that literally at the end of the day, if like the thing we are best at is actually writing, and I think we kind of stopped doing that, honestly, for a while. We got
the opportunity to become directors, and that was so exciting that we just wanted to direct another one.
And then we were becoming producers as well, which it was all kind of, it wasn't like a plan. It was a very organic thing that was happening as our careers were building and expanding into different directions. But as that was happening, looking back, our writing, which is probably the thing we're best at, got kind of pushed to the side a little bit. But now that we've done, I think, a pretty okay job setting up these other things, our producing is going very well, our directing, you know, is established. And so I think we can refocus on writing things and kind of settle back into what we were doing before.
And it's really exciting, too, because the producing and the directing caused this cycle where it was like, we got to get another one out because we need to, you know, you direct one movie, you're not really a director until you direct like two or three things. And then they're like, oh, this guy's not going anywhere.
Yeah. Right.
But now that we've gotten past that hurdle, we can go back to what we really like, which is writing things and not rushing.
Yeah, exactly.
How did the first script you guys collaborated on that got sold or got made cross that chasm?
Superbad?
Yeah.
It took years and years and years. Basically, I moved to LA to do Freaks and Geeks when I was 17.
Just a quick interjection there. Yeah. Why did they do a casting call at your, it was at your high school?
No, it was, they went to Vancouver.
Okay.
Sometimes on,
which is based in LA.
It was set in Michigan. It was shot in LA,
right.
But sometimes, Judd Apatow and Paul Feig, the creator and Judd, the executive producer of Freaks and Geeks, they wanted very real kids, and they had an idea from the beginning that they wouldn't find them in LA. That if you're in LA, you're like an actor kid, and that there's a good chance that you are not what they're looking for. That being said, I think they cast, I think everyone but me and one other guy out of LA, but so they were kind of wrong, but thank God they looked at least. Because so what they did is they did casting calls in Vancouver and Boston and New York and Chicago and Toronto and all these cities, and I got to audition in Vancouver, and they were there. Like, Paul and Judd, like, were in Vancouver.
I didn't know they were actually there.
Yeah, they were, like, in the room. And I recognized Paul Feig because he's in this movie, Ski Patrol, which I had seen.
Ski Patrol?
Yeah, he's in Ski Patrol. And so,
is he the topless woman?
No, you're thinking of Ski School. Ski Patrol is the less pervy version of Ski School.
Then I am not interested.
Yes. Ski Patrol's not that pervy. There's maybe one or two topless women in it. Yeah, it's not Ski School. But that threw me. Anyway, and so they cast me from Vancouver, and I moved to I went there and shot the pilot, and then I came back, and then it got picked up, and then so I was very lucky because I like moved to LA like with a job. Like, I wasn't like I didn't have to like go to LA and like try to find work for myself. Like, I went there employed, which was like, I at the time I didn't realize like how many massive hurdles I was overcoming just by doing that. You know what I mean? And then, so I was there, and then meanwhile, we're writing Superbad, and I give it to Judd. And Judd was very busy at the time running the show, which was like going down in flames, basically, even though it was very good. And so he kind of didn't pay too much attention to it at first. But Jake Kasdan, who was one of the directors of the show, who has gone on to direct tons of movies and stuff like that, he directed the pilot of Freaks and Geeks. He's just like a very nice guy. He was around, he was in his 20s, very young. And so he just like really took a lot of time to like sit with me and talk to me about it. He would give us notes on it. And like, it was just very encouraging because he was like, this is good and you could keep working on this.
Yeah. And I was just at university at McGill in Montreal the whole time because I couldn't come to America even if I wanted to because I didn't have a visa. His dad's American.
My dad's American.
But I wanted to be a writer, and it seemed like, via him on Freaks and Geeks, we had an inlet. Yeah. So I studied U.S. history, so I knew who I was writing for better.
It was a good idea.
I loved history, and I thought if I understood Americans better, I could write better for Americans because I knew that I knew Canadians, and America's quite different.
Yeah. But then after – at some point, Judd did read it, and it was during the show we did Undeclared. So Freaks and Geeks got canceled. And then because Judd read super bad. He got another show going the next year called Undeclared, which was about college freshmen. I was literally the exact age of a college freshman. And so, and he liked how Superbad was written. So he hired me as a writer on the show. And so, and then during Undeclared, he really like took, like a producerial role on Superbad and would give us tons of notes and try to, and that's when we first started going around trying to sell it. That was in like 2000, 2001.
And then 2002,
yeah.
He said, bring your friend on down. I'll throw him a tiny bit of cash so he can live and you guys should try to write something else. So I came down and we spent 2 months writing Pineapple Express, which he told us to come up with 100 ideas for movies, which is insane.
Yeah.
We got to 50, which is great. We never made any of them. And then he was like, these are awesome, but you should instead write a movie about a pothead who's a process server who gets hunted by his own dealer. And we said, that's stupid.
Yeah.
And that will end your career before it ever happens to do like a modern Cheech and Chong. And he just said, but what if it was good?
Yeah. We were like, oh, what if it was good? And we love action movies and, you know, Die Hard and Lethal Weapon. And then we're like, oh, what if we kind of make it like a 90s, like these 90s action movies that we love so much. And so we wrote Pineapple Express pretty fast. Like we just loved it.
Once just
we
started in a few doing weeks it. Or a few months.
We just, and we really just like, we like locked six, ourselves a few in a room.
Like maybe like 6 weeks or something like that.
It was like one of those things where like wake up at 3 p.m. right until 6 a.m.
Yeah, we were very unhealthy at this time in our lives.
Was that the time when we got a Costco card and gained like 20 pounds?
Yeah,
we would get pasta and cheese because it was cheap.
Yeah,
and just eat pasta and cheese stuff. All day long.
Yeah, it was gross. So by the end of, I think, like 2002, both Pineapple Express and Superbad were written and just no one wanted to make them. And it would come close. There'd be someone, oh, we might make it. And then it wouldn't happen. And we might make it.
And every now and then, and like I didn't have the money to do it, I would fly down. We would go and pitch it. Or my dad would drive with me from Vancouver and we'd go and pitch it. And every time we pitched it, probably 10 times, Judd and Seth and me would go and my dad would drop me off and we'd go in and they'd be like, we love this. This is great. And we're like, okay, so you're going to make it? And they're like, oh, no, we can't.
Yeah. And I was supposed to play the Seth role. And slowly throughout this process, like, I still remember the meeting where, like, always I was like, and I'm going to play Seth. And then I remember, like, it took so many years. There was, like, one meeting where I was like, I think this is the meeting where I no longer should say that I'm going to play Seth because I'm 23 years old.
And these were studio heads or studio execs?
It was some new company. Companies with like weird money that comes from who knows where. It was some studios. It was like every type of thing you could imagine, basically.
When did the sort of the other shoe drop in the positive sense?
So, like, meanwhile, like we start getting work. We get hired on the Ali G show, which is great. And it's just it starts to make things like pick up a little for us. I was in the 40-year-old virgin, like things like that started to happen.
And while he was doing 40-year-old virgin, Judd invited me to participate in some capacity, but I knew I had to finish my degree so I could actually stay legally. So I finished my degree and missed out on that. And by the time I came down, the premiere had happened and the movie had hit.
Yeah. And so Judd started to become a successful movie person. He was now a director and a writer and a producer and an incredibly successful one. So an Anchorman had come out and done well, which he was a producer on. And then Talladega Nights came out and did really well. And I think it was...
Wait, Talladega Nights didn't come out before we made Knocked Up. We made Knocked Up first, didn't we? We did.
I don't think so. No, I don't think so. I remember going with Judd to the DeVille Film Festival, I think, for 40-year-old Virgin while he was here in Atlanta, I think, shooting Talladega Nights. I'm bad with years and time, but this is approximately what happened. And then around now, it's like, you know, when you get successful, like Judd was, people just start wanting whatever you have. And so it was Sony was just like, we'll make stuff. And so they made Superbad.
To make an, however much it was, like 22 million, like it was a bizarre model that had never been done. No famous people, low budget. It was kind of an experiment the studio was doing to see if they could make big movies at a smaller budget without famous people.
And they also, what's crazy is Knocked Up, Pineapple Express, and Superbad were all made in like 1 year, I think, basically. Like, we made them like back to back to back because that it was essentially like once the floodgates opened, we just like shoved everything in there that we
had. Because, like, if you just look at like statistically, we're going to be done in 2 years.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
So you have to take advantage of the window.
Yeah, we just took everything. And then Knocked Up and Superbad came out the same summer and both did really, really well.
And so he was a co-producer on 40-Year-Old Virgin.
Yeah.
And they made him an EP on Knocked Up, and Judd just made me an EP too, which was bonkers. And I remember on the third day,
Evan's first day on set, he was an executive producer of like
$30 million
Universal Studios comedy.
And I remember Judd laughed really hard because I was like, "Can I just take however much water I want?" And he was like, "Yeah, man, you can have all the water you want." And I was like, "What about the coffee?" And he was like, "Yeah." So I would have like 14 cups of coffee a day. And I remember I saw Catherine Heigl and I was like, "Hey, what's up? We've been working together for like a week." And then she went up to Seth and was like, "Wow, that guy's got a lot of energy. He's got great enthusiasm. Like, where does he get it from?" And he was like, "Oh, this is his first week on a movie set."
He's had 14 cups of coffee.
Yeah.
What was your reaction, Evan, when you first found out that Superbad was going to get made? I mean, was that...
I assume I freaked out and lost my mind. I don't remember.
Or was it not?
It's such a blur because, as he said, it all went down in 1 year. It was just the most exciting year ever. But also for me, like, he'd been working.
Yeah.
I'd been going to school.
Right, right.
Which meant not going to school and getting drunk and hanging out with friends. Like, I barely went to class. So I had this shocking shift from, like, slacker student to working 14 hours a day. And I remember I would have to sneak away and just, like, go into a bathroom and sleep for, like, 20 minutes because I wasn't used to it. I couldn't handle it. That's why I was drinking so much coffee. It was a really hard transition for me. But Knocked Up was kind of like boot camp.
Yeah.
Because Judd, you know, it was his big shot to make something really huge.
For sure.
So we would go 16 hours, 17 hours, 14 hours.
Long days, yeah.
And I almost lost my mind. But by the end of it, I think I was, like, kind of battle-hardened.
Right. Yeah, conditioned for it all. And what were some of the lessons that you guys have learned from Judd? I mean, what are like some of the takeaways for whether it's the creative process or
that's a whole other part.
Yeah, I mean, it's we could feel.
I mean, I would say the biggest thing we learned from him, in my opinion, is like, and we talked about this earlier, is don't keep stuff to yourself. Like, you're surrounded by smart people. Bring them in. Get other people's opinions. Share it with them.
Yeah.
And most importantly, emotion is what matters. It's an emotional journey. It doesn't matter if the aircraft carrier hits the skyscraper and it collapses onto the hero. It's what is he feeling when that happens, and why does it matter that he has to get out of the rubble?
Yeah.
He just taught us, like, emotion is the key. Like, the 40-Year-Old Virgin is a crazy weird movie. It's insane, but it's about a guy who's got, like, a wound that he wants to heal, and through this journey he does. And it's all about that.
Well, you mentioned that to me, and every character has to have a wound of some
that's
type.
A big Juddism.
Yeah, I think, I mean, about the process, I mean, he basically, like, taught us the process that we use a lot. I mean, especially in regards to collaboration and
improv. He was somewhat revolutionary in how he did it. Like, people had done it before, like Christopher Guest and other people, but Judd figured out a way to make improv and mainstream movies collide in a way that I don't think anyone had.
No one was
time.
Really doing it like that. And yeah, I mean, the filming process itself, and how to work on set is something he's taught us a lot about. I mean, again, and it was stuff that was partially figured out together, but he worked for years and years and years before us. And I mean, it's so funny. I remember one time we were filming a scene in Knocked Up, I think, and improvising, or maybe it was even 40-Year-Old Virgin, and the direction he screamed at us, because he screams direction from another room a lot, which is hilarious. But what he screamed at us was, "Less semen, more emotion." And I think, like, that is actually, like, an across-the-board good note to apply to things.
And yet still, we managed to get quite a bit of semen in there.
Yeah. But I think it was just the area we were riffing on. But I think, what Evan was saying is exactly right. Like, the emotional core. Like, what is it really about? Like, and that movies can be very sweet and still, like, and especially if you're gonna make a movie that is so, like, you know, dirty or aggressively, you know, filled with profanity and that thing, that like it helps if they're sweet and if you right. really like, if they're not mean spirited, and if you and write what you know was a big thing, and try to inject your own like honesty and experiences into your work, even if it's a weird spy movie or end of the world
like,
movie.
Like This Is the End is just about Jay and Seth, and Jay is upset that Seth has found new friends, and Seth is upset that Jay seems to be holding on to the past. That's what the movie's about. It right. has nothing to do with the apocalypse, really. That's just the area it all went down in.
Yeah.
For, when looking at filmmaking or comedy movies specifically, if you guys could have written something that someone else wrote, right, besides your own stuff, where you're like, oh, I wish...
Adaptation.
Yeah.
Wow. All right.
It's the best movie ever.
I love that. Yeah.
It's a masterpiece. And the script is even better than the movie.
The script is great. The script is great.
Movie, I think they made the right choice with the changes they made, but the script is... Just unreal.
Fantastic.
That's like one of those, not a lot of movies make me like mind-blowingly jealous, but when I saw that, I was just like,
ugh. That ended like five of my best ideas. Like I was like, oh, there should be a movie with someone who has anxiety represented by a character. And I was like, oh, he did this 10 times better than I ever could. Plus 10 other things that I had.
And it's the whole, and the movie's like funny and awesome. And like, it's just,
and just the story of how that came together also in terms of
that he was hired to write the adaptation and then he freaked out and couldn't do it. I mean, it's like,
it's unspeakably genius.
The meta backstory is so funny.
And then I would say on a flip side, to me, the most magical, emotional, beautiful movie is The Princess Bride.
My favorite. Yeah.
It's so good. I can't watch it too much.
That was, you know, I've had this fascination with screenwriting, even though I haven't pulled the trigger on anything. But the screenplay that did it was The Princess Bride. William Goldman?
Yeah. The book on it is good.
So good.
It's a great
movie. All the backstory. So one of the scenes in adaptation, because you mentioned it, one of my favorite scenes is when he's sitting in the movie, Nicolas Cage sitting in his apartment at this typewriter, and he's like... And you hear his internal
dialogue.
Yeah, he's like, I should really have a muffin. God, I'm so hungry. Like, I really need some coffee.
Don't think better if I have a muffin.
What are your opinions of writer's block?
Oh, we touched on this earlier. I think writer's block is complete bullshit.
Really?
And is it? Yeah, I think it's a term.
I'll hear the debate.
I have it right now.
I think it is a term. Like, it's a term people give to a bad week. Like. Yeah. I have bad weeks. I don't have writer's block. Writer's block implies that like you can't do it. Some things are just harder than other things.
But I
you could have said that we had writer's block on This Is the End when we couldn't figure out the third act. I don't call that writer's block. I say that was the biggest struggle of This Is the End.
I think that we just have never experienced it, which is why you don't think it exists. But I think that like...
You think that we've never... No way.
I think what happens to people actually, and we're just lucky that we haven't experienced it, is they become uninspired. Like that, I think, is what writer's block is. And we're just lucky because that has never happened to us. I take
issue with the term, especially block.
It's just the term.
Writer's difficulties. Writer's struggle.
No, but I think...
Writer's cramp.
Block implies like it's just not going to happen.
But I think you truly lose... your inspiration or who you are as a creative person. I think people experience those moments and that's writer. I think that's what writers
do. Do you think that, what would you attribute that to? Do you think that's because you guys are writing what you know or what is so present for the time?
Thing is when one of us is not doing great, the other one can pick up the weight.
Yeah.
And when one of us is uninspired, the other one can be inspired.
Like, there's moments where I'm just like, I don't even know what the fuck we're doing anymore. Why are we doing this? And then he'll just have an idea and I have to just keep going. And then you plow through. And there's probably moments where he's thinking the similar thing. And in that moment, I'm not thinking that. And so it allows us to keep going.
But there's a beauty to writing stuff on your own. But specifically for movies, I think writing as a team is extremely beneficial. And even if you do write alone, you should be sharing what you're writing with everyone all the time, because writer's block, as some call it, and I would rather not, could easily be solved by just getting someone to help you.
Right.
And I think a lot of writers, the biggest problem I think writers have is they're like, I can't show people until it's ready. And that's poppycock. Like,
I think you need to show it immediately. I think you need to talk about your ideas early. And I think that's how, if you have writer's block, that, like, there's probably a reason you have it. There's probably a reason you're uninspired, and that is the thing you should be writing about. Like, I think, and I think in order to arrive at that, you need to talk to someone sometimes. Like, and I think that's why it's helpful to have another person, is like, we're very open with each other. We talk about pretty much everything that's happening in our lives with one another. And so it's not like I'd just be sitting there grumpy and he's like, got any ideas? Like, no, not feeling it today. I would explain why, and that would probably lead to an idea, because we like to write in that
and
way.
And I guess that's why, to both of us, adaptation's the most genius thing ever, because
it's a movie about writer's block.
A guy took writer's block and made it something. Yep. Yeah. And I guess that's my beef with writer's block, is like, it's just something stopping you, but it'll put you in another direction. So it's still the path you're taking.
Who in your mind, whether right now, you know, alive or dead, are the most some of the more underrated comedy writers?
Well, Hannibal Buress is a stand-up comic. He's not a full writer, but that man is an unspeakable genius.
Hannibal Buress?
Buress.
Okay.
He started this whole Bill Cosby thing.
Yeah. Bill Cosby started.
Well, Bill Cosby started it.
I'm going to attribute that to Hannibal.
We have a guy we're working with named Joe Mandy, who's bizarrely funny. Genius.
I think Sasha's one of the funniest guys
ever. Sacha Baron Cohen.
Gary Shandling is brilliant to me. Like, the Larry Sanders Show, I think, in a lot of ways, does a lot of the stuff that a lot of people try to do today.
There's an animator who I think, and writer who I think is one of the greatest geniuses to ever live, named Don Hertzfeldt.
Yeah, and not a lot of people know
the
who he
funniest.
Is. He's amazing.
He made this thing called Rejected.
Yeah.
That is the funniest thing I think I may have ever seen in my entire life.
It's crazy.
He animates by hand, usually with a 16mm camera. He just started using computers a little, but
it's
like stick figures, literally, and it's. It's the most genius thing I've ever seen.
Yeah, he's incredible. He's probably not as lauded as one could be. I think he gets nominated for
I think he won an Oscar, actually.
So never mind. Fuck. He's also really good looking. I think Matt and Trey of South Park and Book of Mormon, to me, are like two of the funniest humans ever created. Again, Judd and... Who's like growing up, I was really into SCTV, like Martin Short.
And especially as Canadians,
John Candy and
Kids in the Hall and SCTV played on a loop.
Yeah, so Kids in the Hall.
Kids in the Hall is like...
I think Kids in the Hall was very influential on us, and we watched it a ton growing up. I've seen every single episode. Like, I never will turn on an episode, and it's one I haven't seen.
Do you want to see one that kind of changed our lives?
The Shirley, which is one of the weirdest things.
And they did this short, I believe, called
How do you
Sausages.
Spell that?
Sausages.
Sausages.
S-H-I-R-L-I-N-G.
It's
a made-up word. Right. And so, but what was great about Kids in the Hall is how insane it was. And at the time it didn't seem insane because we watched it so much and it was on so much.
But as we got older and started to make stuff, we realized, like, I don't think I could get that show on air right now.
No, it's crazy.
It's so bonkers. And the fact that they got to do whatever they wanted, even though like 2 out of the 5 times it was a big miss.
Yeah.
The other times it's just like they nailed it because they got to do what they really wanted to in their hearts.
And like, we've got to work with Lorne Michaels, and I've got to be around him a bunch. And like, that's one of the things we talk to him about the most every time we're around him. And he's very proud of the show, but he says, I mean, he's like, the key to that show was letting those guys do whatever they wanted. And that was it. He's like, that was that show was like, they had to do all of it, 'cause that's how crazy it was.
Also, quickly, Mel Brooks was like a huge thing.
Lauren is amazing. I mean, he's not like known as being a writer by trade or anything, but he's a very funny guy. And like,
he's like the Steve Jobs of comedy.
Yeah, and it's unbelievable what he's done. And like, he's someone that every time I'm around him, it's like, it's truly like an awe-inspiring.
And we
thing
also, just from being in Canada, we had a lot of British television, so we got a lot of those British
comedy
shows.
Yeah, like Fawlty Towers and Monty Python.
And I think that gave us like an attitude towards comedy. That
Ab Fab. Did you watch that growing up? My mom.
No,
watched
I don't know.
Absolutely fabulous. It was a great show. Yeah. But yeah, my parents were really into comedy and watched a lot of Woody Allen movies when I was growing up. And like,
are there any late bloomers in comedy writing who have not, say, known since they were kids that they wanted to be in comedy or in writing, who have kind of come onto the scene and done well? That come to mind.
I mean,
that come to mind. Maybe not. There must be.
I mean, it's a tough question, but I figured.
It's a good one. I can't think of anyone.
Or comedy directing, acting.
Tim Ferriss.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. The answer is Tim Ferriss.
When I'm funny, it's usually accidental.
I'm going to go with Elon Musk on that.
Yeah, Elon exactly. Musk. No, I can't think of anyone. All right, I'll one of those things though, where it's like. And I think it's what brings comedians together. It's so funny because, like, whenever you go, I don't often, but at the times I do go to, like, a Hollywood type party, all the comedians are often, like, lumped together in one little section because they often all know each other and often they're the type, they're similar types of people. They've, for whatever bizarre reason, known since they were little kids that they want to be comedians.
I think you can boil it down, and this is maybe overgeneralizing, but comedians know that life is ridiculous.
Yeah.
And I think that's like a common bond that holds them all together.
Well, they're all the
like,
kids.
Like, we're never going to figure this out. This is all absurd. Yeah. And let's kind of analyze how ridiculous.
And at the party,
this is.
They're all the people who want to stand in the corner and make fun of the party they're at. And so they all go to, and then sometimes the whole party is that.
Brian Callen, who's been on the podcast, and Buddy's a stand up comic.
Oh, yeah.
He's done a lot of acting. And he gave me my first tour of the comedy store.
He's in the 40-Year-Old Virgin movie knockoff. Yeah. Right?
Oh, which one? I don't
know. The 40-Year-Old Virgin who knocked up Sarah Marshall Superman thing. I think he is. I could be wrong. But he
gave me my first tour at the comedy store, and a bunch of the comics just ended up standing outside, basically making fun of the party and shooting the shit. But
that's where the real comedy is right outside the comedy club. I think
when you guys think of it could be more broadly outside of comedy, like Evan, I'll ask you first. When you think of the word successful, who is the first person who comes to mind for you?
Honestly, my cousin David.
Why is that?
I got two cousins, David and Charlie, who live in Orange County, and they just have a really nice life and two great kids. And every time I go to their house, I think this is the most successful group of people I know, just because they're really happy and they all really like each other. And it's rare to have a family that everyone likes everyone and they're all proud of each other. So corny answer, but my cousins, David.
Why
and
do
Charlie.
You think more people aren't like that or don't have that?
I think they just made up their minds. And I think other people deliberate too much. Like, they were just like, he was like, I'm a doctor. She was like, I'm going to be a teacher. We want two kids. We're going to live there. And we're going to make the best of our lives and go to the beach whenever we can. They just like, they seem to have cut through a lot of the bullshit and made their lives very simple in a beautiful way. And it's all about their kids. And I don't know. I just feel like they are the most level-headed people I know who have stuff like really figured out.
Seth, what about yourself?
When you got to say something
successful.
Emotional. You're going to be a
I
jerk.
Know. Michael Jordan. I don't know. My parents, I feel like, seem pretty happy. and I definitely don't ascribe like a financial meaning to it off the top of my head. Yeah, my parents are on a cruise in Alaska right now eating. They just sent me a picture of a meal that entirely comprised of tater tots and beer. So I'd say they're doing pretty well right now.
His dad has somehow made vegetarianism unhealthy to
my
a degree.
The most unhealthy vegetarian on the entire planet. But yeah, my parents are very, very happy, honestly. And have always seemed they're pretty like zen, I gotta say, which to me is like a good place to be, and what I strive to be is just at peace with myself.
Do you, Seth, give books as gifts ever? If so, I mean, do you have a most gifted book that you've given to people?
I don't give books as gifts. I give sometimes like coffee table type books as gifts. But like if someone's in a mood, like I like coffee table books. I read and I give comic books sometimes to people. I don't often give books to people as gifts because I'm not myself like a huge reader. I'm not like
a... But which comic?
have I given to people? I've given Preacher to people. I've given Watchmen to people. I've given Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy to people because I love that book. And if they tell me they haven't read it, I give that to them. I've given this book, The Art of Dramatic Writing, to people because it's
by Lajos Egri. That's something Judd told us to read.
That's a book Judd gave us.
The Art of Dramatic.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you're a writer, 60% of it's useless and 40% of it is gold.
It references a lot of plays that if you haven't read and you haven't because no who has, it just doesn't. A lot of it is very referential to certain plays.
The best part of it is it explains the importance of premise and how you must have a rock solid one sentence premise before you dive in.
A thesis for the movie itself. I remember when Judd gave it to us, he said it was Woody Allen's favorite writing book, which was meaningful at the time. And so I've given that book to people. Conquest of Happiness I've given to people because a great book.
That's by Bertrand Russell. It's like the original.
If you ignore like the
book.
Racial epitaphs,
at the time
were more acceptable than they are. It was written in like 1920 or something like that, I think, right? But it's a great. It's like one of the OG self help books, basically, right? I think like the gist of the book is like. Some say life is pleasurable, some say it isn't, so why think about it? and so I've given those books to people, yeah, but not I don't give a ton of books to people.
And I know we only have a little bit of time left, but Evan, what about yourself? Do you have a most gifted book?
Every person who becomes a mother, who's a friend of mine, I send this Canadian child's book, Love You Forever, to, which I think is just
Love You Forever, the number two, or
Love You Forever. It's got a thing, Love You Forever, Love You For Always. As long as you're living, my baby, you'll be. It's like a thing between a mother and son. And I think that's a beautiful book that I give to
it's
anybody
really
who's
sad.
Had a kid. But it's beautiful.
it's like the Little Prince. It's unbelievably depressing.
No one's been upset I gave it to them.
Really? Not to you.
And the Little Prince is phenomenal. Hitchhiker's Guide. And then I often give Preacher, V for Vendetta, and The Watchmen to people. But my main thing is Love You Forever. I think that like anyone who has a kid should have that book.
Now, we were talking about this briefly yesterday, but could you describe the habit that you picked up from Snoop Dogg in the context?
We were smoking pot with Snoop Dogg.
What habit did you pick up?
And this is when we were recording that song,
yeah.
And we were hanging out with him, and we were smoking
pot.
You
have hose come in when you write now?
Yeah.
I can only write with hose around.
And I don't know how we got to this, but he was like... Yeah. You like to go for walks? I was like, not really. I don't really. He's like, what do you mean? I was like, I'll go for like exercise or whatever, but I don't just go for walks. And he looked at me really disappointed and was like, you should go for walks, man. That's a bad move. You're making a bad mistake. And it like haunted me that like Snoop Dogg was disappointed that I didn't take walks. So I started taking a walk in the morning and a walk after dinner, and it has like massively changed my life. I sleep better. I have a better day because I just walk for like 10 minutes.
Yeah.
But he just kind of went on like a little mini rant saying like, walking's great, man. It's important. I walk with my kids.
It's one of the reasons people like having dogs.
Yeah.
You walk them.
Yeah.
Steve Jobs was a famous walker. I'm not joking.
Yeah, yeah.
He was known for like doing meetings on walks. Like instead of like sitting in a office doing a meeting, they would walk around. And
Now I've become obsessed with like, I will stretch during meetings and I don't care who it's with.
Yeah.
I will stand for full meetings because I don't like sitting. And we're trying to get a new office. And when we do, I'm putting a treadmill in there,
yeah.
a bunch of other stuff. Cause when we're writing, I'm often just like walking around the room. Like
I pace
spinning
a
pencil in my head.
You should try a treadmill desk.
My friend has it.
It takes a little while to get used to.
But I don't think I could do that.
I've heard it's good. I saw someone running on a treadmill reading a book at the gym this morning.
That sounds like a great
No one's written a hilarious joke on a treadmill.
Yeah.
That's never happened in the history of comedy.
I have an elevating desk that goes up and down, but right. I will try the treadmill desk.
The key is not running.
Yeah, exactly.
and having a safety clip on. If you could have given your, say, let's just say 25-year-old self some advice, what would you have said?
I would have told myself to lose weight.
earlier.
Yeah. I just lost like 25 pounds and I feel so much better and my brain is so much sharper. And I wasn't like massively overweight, but I was overweight for those from 25 to 31. And that was a very, very big mistake. That was very fixable. And I wish that I could go back in time and be like, just start walking, yo.
Start walking.
Some nice walks. We'll fix this all. And I found out I was allergic to wheat, so I wish I could go back in time and tell myself that.
Don't eat wheat.
Because I found that out 3 years ago, and if I found that out 6 years ago, I would have had a lot better of a decade.
What about yourself, Seth?
I don't know. I was probably a lot healthier when I was probably doing better by all means when I was 25 than I am right now. I probably would have told myself to propose to my wife sooner.
Oh yeah, me too. Me too.
That would have saved me.
And why is that?
Just because I waited. I waited like 6.5 years.
Is it a coincidence we both made that mistake?
I don't know. Probably not. But it was probably like, what do they call that? Enabling? I think we probably enabled each other.
I was like, Seth's not doing it. Yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, I don't have any like major regrets that have occurred between now and then or any like, I think there's lessons I've learned, but they've been valuable and organic to my living process. But the proposal, I should have propose sooner. That I would have done differently.
I suppose this could be maybe a similar type of question, but for you, Evan, if you could have one billboard anywhere that said anything, what would be on it?
I've had a lot of billboards, so that's a tough one for me to answer. I've been on the
His would say, would you have a child with this guy or whatever knocked up one?
The night before, coming out November 24th.
I guess my biggest beef with the world that I would throw up on a billboard is this is going to get deep, guys.
No.
Accept each other.
Whoa, Evan.
Boom.
I don't accept that.
I don't like when people don't accept one another. I think they should. And I would put it on top of the Empire State Building.
Really? People wouldn't see it very well up there.
Okay, fine. I put it at the bottom of the Empire State Building.
On the entryway to the Empire State Building. Accept each other is good. I like that. Accept each other.
Or just accept me with a picture except of me.
Accept Seth Rogen.
Well, I know we're wrapping up here. You guys have a lot to do.
We have some more time.
You got like 11 more minutes. Yeah, 11 more minutes.
We can go. Yeah. Okay. For 10 more
all right.
Minutes,
in so. That case, I would like to.
When we leave, we have to go back to our jobs.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Well, right. I'm not so eager
I'll,
to go to my
I'll,
job.
I'll help postpone that a little bit. So I'd like to ask a couple of fan questions. This one is from Kyle Bailey. He wants to know about the future of comedy, and this is what he says:
robots, singularity, string theory. What is funny on one side of the universe creates a funny reaction on the other side. No one knows why.
He says it seems to me that late 70s and then 80s satire, Saturday Night Live, Seinfeld has led to all things funny, that has led to all things funny being absurd, hence Old Spice commercials having Minotaur and so on. Seems like the more absurd the funnier, at least in the mainstream. When will this snap back, or when will we experience the next direction of comedy, or is absurdity the final act of comedy? And then somebody added to that specifically on online, where you're trying to grab attention in a distraction economy.
I heard actually with marketing specifically recently, someone told me that that now commercials like actually do better if they make no sense. Like that literally just like
Mountain Dew commercial. Have you guys seen that Mountain Dew
or
commercial?
Or the one with like the horse and the one where it's like, this horse, I tell you, like there's literally like, someone was explaining to me the theory where it's like the fact that they make no sense actually makes you pay more attention to them than a traditional commercial narrative. I actually don't necessarily agree with that.
Yeah, I gotta disagree.
It depends a lot.
Like Superbad's not absurd. Transparent's not absurd.
Or like Trainwreck is one of the biggest comedies of the year, and it's like completely, you know, a very grounded movie.
We love ourselves some absurd comedy, but there's room even, for both, and always
Neighbors is our most successful movie, and in a lot of ways, like it goes, it's quite broad at times, but in premise, it's about people who have a bunch of kids moving next door to them. Like, it's not that bizarre, you know? So I think the biggest comedies are not absurd. They're somewhat grounded in reality, and the less, the somewhat popular, but maybe less popular comedies, like This Is the End, which did very well, but isn't in the same universe as like Neighbors or Trainwreck is doing much better than that. Like, I think those truly absurd ones actually don't do as well as the more grounded ones.
Well, it's like, you know, Memento. I mean, not absurd, but so it's confusing to so many people. I mean, yeah. I love Memento, but it's been sort of kind of disheartening to find that a lot of my favorite movies did very, very, very poorly at the box office.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of movies...
We always say this, like we'll never be number one, and if we are, we won't be that cool anymore.
Yeah, like, it's true. Like, we always will have the sensibility where it's like, things everyone loves, I hate, and things everyone hates, I love. And I'm just... And I don't mean that in, like, I'm not trying to be, like, a hipster. And I do. I also love a lot of mainstream stuff. And like, I'm the first guy in line to see a Michael Bay movie when it comes out. But
Fast and Furious is the greatest time you could have in a movie theater.
But that being said, like, there's some shows that are really popular. I'm just like, I don't understand why people like this. And there's some shows that no one likes. And I'm like, I don't get why people don't love this, you know? And as long as you have that sensibility, I think there's a good chance you will not be the most successful person.
Well, so, along those lines, and so Freaks and Geeks, looking back at that, I mean, and this is a question from Nick Abregu, what was it about Freaks and Geeks that made everyone so successful in their later careers? Is it, would you attribute to advice they received or more of a networking effect or otherwise? I'm paraphrasing, but...
I think, honestly, I mean, my hope is that Judd just and Paul found people who happened to be very talented and had the talent to sustain themselves. And
so they cast very well.
Yeah, I think they cast very well.
And like having cast movies with Judd, like, he's just got the eye, man.
He's very good at seeing.
Is it just an instinctual thing, or is there some?
You get better at it. It's literally just there's not that many really funny people. And like, when you see someone who's actually very funny, like, and if you're, it's again what we, you know, you talk about it with investments. It's the exact, like, you start to hone in on just like things that for whatever reason you start to think like, this is good. Like, and I think you can train yourself to become more and more in tune with it. And I think that's one of the things Judd taught us, is like, keep your eyes out for that person. If you're watching a movie and someone is in one scene and has one line and is funny, that person could star in a whole movie one day, maybe.
Yeah,
you know?
In The First Neighbors, there's this stand-up Gerard Carmichael who's in it, has his own show, and we're trying to write a movie with our guys Kyle and Ariel for him to star in, and it all just came from our co-worker Alex saying, I saw this guy, and he's got it.
Yeah.
Lick yourself like a cat.
And I think more than anything, that's what it is that he has a very good... You know, Paul and Judd both have very good eyes for spotting people that will keep working.
And another thing is, they look long and hard. Yeah. Like, when we were looking for who was going to be the McLovin Fogel character in Superbad, it literally came down to putting up signs in high schools. Yeah. Allison Jones, the casting director, did an epic search. Literally, just putting up signs. Does anyone know anyone who fits this bill? And his buddies were like, you should go.
That's cool.
And do this.
That's
and
a very smart approach.
We saw, like, I don't know, 100 kids. And then that's just what we saw, filtered from the casting director onto us. Yeah. And it's like a Hollywood cliche almost, but when you see that person, you go, it's him.
That's the one.
Yeah.
So just on McLovin, because this came up surprisingly often. So Justin Nina Basti, I think, and then Dan GMO Designs, I'm not sure, ask them if they would ever be willing to make a spin-off movie about McLovin.
We are not, but we have discussed, which we'll never do, what I'm about to say, but we always thought it would be funny to kind of do something where you take Saul from Pineapple Express, the James Franco character, and McLovin from Superbad, and put them in a movie together, but it's never happened.
Now, why would you never do it?
In the same way that Donald Trump thinks if he changes his hair, he'll ruin his career.
Yeah.
To us, like, Superbad worked. It was everything we ever hoped it would be, and more. And I'm not touching it. Yeah. I'm not.
It's like if you throw two bullseyes, you're like, no, I'm done with that.
Just back away.
If I made a sequel to Superbad and it was bad, it would crush me.
Exactly. Yeah.
I don't want to mess with it.
I couldn't deal with that.
Does so? Of course, weed comes up a lot.
What's that?
The marijuana. Do you find it helps creativity, productivity? Neither, both. I mean, because there are questions about, like, how do you be
debatable.
So productive? But for you two guys, what impact does it have on your work?
I would say that it makes you a little dumber while you're on it. But for us, no matter what job you have, no matter how amazing it is, it's work. And work in some ways sucks. And what we've tried to do at our office, like, we have a big buck hunter in our office. And just taking 5 minutes and playing around a big buck hunter, it, like, lets you chill out. Going for a little walk to get a cup of coffee.
Well,
for some people, it's a very, very bad idea. I would say, like, most people, it makes them work so much worse that they shouldn't. But some people, it relaxes
them. I think what's important, I think why it's helpful to us is because it's what we do socially. And so it makes work not feel like work. And I was actually just like yesterday reading this thing that Isaac, like it was an old article that Isaac Asimov wrote about the creative process that was just republished. And one of the things he talks a lot about is in his process how it's very important to create like a casual environment. And he says like you shouldn't work in an office. You should work in someone's living room or in a restaurant. And you should, and you need people who are jovial, who create a fun environment, because a lot of writing is failure. And if you're self-conscious that you're going to be rejected, then you won't say your best ideas. And I think, again, I think our thing happens to be smoking weed. With some people, it's other things, but I think because it makes our working feel like a not working environment, it makes our brains function in a slightly more free way, and it makes us pitch ideas that maybe we would feel were too stupid to pitch if we were in a more rigid environment, and it would make ideas like This Is the End not exist. Not because we're stoned, but because we're working in an environment that feels very safe and that feels very social and casual, and that lets us pitch out the ideas that might seem like the craziest ideas you could ever pitch out. But because we don't feel like we're in a work environment where everyone's judging us and that we're wasting time or not, you know, hitting the numbers or quotas that we have to be hitting, it allows us, I think, to be more free creative.
Yeah, like in our office right now, Seth has a bunch of paintings that he's bought over the years from home, and he put them around, and it feels like home.
That's
yeah,
I like
and
that.
I have I like my that. Yoga blocks and my yoga straps, and doing the stretches to me is akin to the smoking pot, which
you
is
one
like,
of the best Caucasian squats I've ever seen.
Thank you, sir.
You know, he doesn't have the sitting position usually. He goes from straight standing to perfect. As in Japan, they would call it unkozawari. Unkozawari is the shit squat.
Yeah.
Tell him what you bought me.
I bought Evan like a platform that goes around his toilet so he can squat and shit into his
the toilet.
Toilet
server.
If there's one thing people listening to this should take from this podcast, it's you should be squatting when you shit. It's natural. It's better for you. It's bad for your back. It's bad for your bowels to sit on a toilet. Pop a squat.
What do you guys use? Now, I feel like since you guys grew up in BC, that it's for... That is to pot as like growing up in France would be to wine.
Yeah.
So is there a particular type of pot? Because I've had friends be like, no, man, you get anxious because of this. You're using the wrong thing.
I will say that those friends are possibly correct. I had somebody who was telling me the pot's too strong. I don't like it. It makes me anxious. So I went to one of the stores in California and said, can you give me some pot from 1995? And they did. And I gave it to the person and they were like, there you go.
It's not that's literally what from I was 1995. But
no, the vibe.
It's as strong. As basically
yeah.
Like,
oh, yeah. That's right, because I've heard
basically
it's
like the weakest, like what is the absolute worst weed you could buy now is what the best weed was when we were in high school, probably. You know?
We have a problem where people will smoke pot with us and we'll be like, take it easy. We don't smoke weak stuff.
Yeah, we continued smoking good weed.
but to get name specific, Jack Hare.
Yeah, that's good weed.
Is a good working one. There's also good ones for work and ones that
it's
work.
Very simple. There's sativas and indicas. And sativas are generally kind of uppers, and indicas are generally kind of downers. And when you're working, a sativa is generally better because
Jack
it's not
Hare.
Bogging you down.
Jack Hare, like a name.
H-E-R-R-E-R.
H-E-R-R-E-R. I think there's one R in the middle, but...
Do you guys have any, just in closing, ask or recommendation... of the people listening?
I would say the reason that this podcast is happening right now is because with that guy Don Hertzfeldt I mentioned, there was one day where I was sitting there, I was like, God, what I would do to talk to him. And then I just picked up the phone and called my agent and was like, can you get me Don Hertzfeldt's number? And I talked to him, and it blew my mind. And then I had the same thing with this guy Sam Harris, who I look up to very much,
Sam
and
Harris,
I like
amazing.
The work of. And I just called him, and so... I reached out to you in the same way, and you write about this in your book as well. And I just think if you idolize someone or you look up to someone or you respect someone's work, try to get in touch with them. There's no harm. And so far, I'm 3 for 3, and I have an advantageous position with an agent and all that.
Incredibly successful producer, writer, director.
But still, there's some guy named Jordan who I ran into on the street who I email with.
Yeah.
And he now works at Funny or Die, and I keep him in mind. And I don't know this guy from anything. He just came up to me one day on the street, and it's worth a shot. You never know.
Yeah, like, if what's the worst that could happen? Right? Yeah.
Well, this Jordan guy could kill me one day. He could be a serial killer.
You're like totally the wrong people to ask that.
Evan eaten by Jordan.
But no, it's so true. I mean, some fans of mine have reached out to Warren Buffett and gotten handwritten letters back from him.
Yeah.
You just never know.
Yeah. Well, it's the same thing. Like sometimes, like Seth and I always talk about this, we'll find ourselves doing like an interview or something, and we look at each other and we're like, when did we agree to this? Why would we do this?
Yeah.
Sometimes people just drop their guards and agree to shit they should.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not sure if that's if that's like a wink wink at me at the moment.
Yeah, yeah. I've been in whole movies. I don't understand why.
Yeah. And like you call the person on the one day where their will is exhausted from whatever else. Yeah. And they're just like, yeah, man, I'll meet with you as long as I can get off this phone call.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
Now.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. That's what I think too, is just do it. I mean, like
Nike,
you meet so many people, Nike. I mean, Nike has the best tagline of all time, but it's like so many people talk about writing movies, and we did write a movie. And like, you know, my wife wanted to make a movie, and so she raised $1 million and made a movie. Like, it's not something that is completely unachievable. It's something that if you are somewhat talented and have a lot of determination and are willing to put yourself out there and are willing to fail, then you can probably do something more than nothing.
Yeah. And like in the end, Superbad was a success, but like, make no mistake, for 10 years, it was a failure.
Yeah.
And the first 5 drafts, like, if you read them, you'd be like, this is the worst thing I've ever read in my life.
And people told us over and over and over again, like, I don't think anyone's going to make this movie. I don't think anyone's going to make this movie. And, like, it literally didn't even occur to us to listen to them. Like, it wasn't even a conversation of, like, should we stop? Like, we didn't even have that conversation. Yeah, fuck those people. Let's go to the next ones, you know?
Like, to picture, like, Stephen King writing his first book and then being like, man, I'm stumped.
Yeah.
I'm going to go be a something else. Like,
Brand,
you just keep going.
Blind belief in yourself. Yeah.
Funny that the 4-hour work week was turned down 26 or 27 times also. I mean, viciously, like violently. I have these like angry, sort of infuriated, insulted letters from acquiring editors turned it down. All right, guys. Well, I really appreciate all the time. Let's wrap up, and we can do that with telling people where they can find more about you guys, find you on the social webs, and so on, if they want to say hi.
We due to a film called The Interview, we're not as active on the internet as we used to be.
I'm pretty active.
I muck about on Twitter a little. And
you're Evan Goldberg on
I'm Evan Goldberg on Twitter.
Is it Evan or Evan D. Goldberg?
I think it's just Evan Goldberg.
I think it's just Evan Goldberg. It's been a while.
I will put it in the show notes for everybody also.
I'm Seth Rogen on Twitter.
And that's Rogen with an E or an A?
With an E. Not to be confused.
If you write a letter and put it under the second O in the Hollywood sign, or the second L in the Hollywood sign,
yeah, exactly.
We go up there and we'll read it.
All right, guys. Well, thanks so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it. Everybody listening, of course, thank you for listening as always. And for all the show notes and everything else, you can go to 4hourworkweek.com, spelled out, and just click on podcast. And until next time, thanks for listening. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Hey guys, this is Tim again. Just a few more things before you take off. Number one, this is 5 Bullet Friday. Do you want to get a short email from me? Would you enjoy getting a short email from me every Friday that provides a little morsel of fun before the weekend? And 5 Bullet Friday is a very short email where I share the coolest things I've found or that I've been pondering over the week. That could include favorite new albums that I've discovered. It could include gizmos and gadgets and all sorts of weird shit that I've somehow dug up in the world of the esoteric as I do. It could include favorite articles that I've read and that I've shared with my close friends, for instance. And it's very short. It's just a little tiny bite of goodness before you head off for the weekend. So if you want to receive that, check it out. Just go to 4hourworkweek.com. That's 4hourworkweek.com, all spelled out, and just drop in your email and you will get the very next one. And if you sign up, I hope you enjoy it.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig, inspiring kid confidence.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.